If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we're stepping into a story that's, well, it's incredibly sad, but also genuinely unsettling. It's from 1998.
Yeah, set in a quiet town, residential area, just outside Seattle.
And it's all focused on one man, a man named Fred Foster.
This is really a deep dive into, you could say, the architecture of grief. We've pulled together the details of Fred's life and his final act. We're using a core narrative account called The Cardboard Neighborhood, Fred Foster's Final Words.
Okay.
And we're also bringing in some context, some structural parallels from the Inspector Story podcast series Index to help understand his devotion and isolation.
Right. So our mission today is to take this slow, really deliberate. We want to understand not just what Fred did, but try to get at the why.
Yeah, the human truth behind these really unsettling details of what he built.
Because this isn't just a story about someone being eccentric. You know, it feels like more. It feels like this catastrophic collision between one man's desperate need for connection and, well, the reality of the outside world.
Absolutely. We're trying to find the structure, you could say, within the decay.
Mm-hmm.
And with material this specific, this intense, you need guides, right?
Definitely.
So the index gives us these four structural blueprints. They help analyze intense self-imposed isolation, devotion to. We'll connect Fred's story to other cases, individuals who chase their own realities so hard they actually fundamentally change the world around them.
It sets a certain tone right from the start, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
A kind of somber way. The quote that framed the original source material sort of sets the stage, and it's stark. It just says, what happened to this man was truly horrible.
Hmm. It certainly was.
Okay, so let's introduce Fred Foster properly.
Right.
Part one, the architect of isolation and grief. The setting is key here, right?
Yeah.
1998, a quiet, almost forgettable suburb near Seattle.
Yeah, and his circumstance is critical. He was recently widowed. And that loss, the loss of his wife, it seems to be the gravitational center for everything that happened next.
Neighbors, what did they think? They described him kindly, it seems.
Kindly, yes, but with this growing sense of distance. He was seen as harmless, maybe a little odd, you know, but fundamentally just a man dealing with this huge vacuum in his life.
And people react to grief differently. Some try to fill the emptiness. Fred's way was unique.
Extremely unique. He didn't just retreat inwards. He tried to physically rebuild his entire social landscape. And we really need to stress the scale here. This wasn't like a little craft project he did inside.
No, not at all. The sources call it an architectural devotion. It spilled out of his backyard, started encroaching on the public park behind his house. It became massive.
What kind of materials are we talking about? Just boxes?
Huge quantities of packing boxes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But also mailing tubes, tons of duct tape, whatever glue he could find that would hold up sort of against the Pacific Northwest dampness.
And he was building, what exactly?
A neighborhood.
Yeah.
Dozens of tiny houses. Some were two, even three stories tall.
Mm.
He cut out little windows, painted brickwork onto the cardboard.
And inside these shells, he built intricate little furniture. Tiny trees made from tightly rolled cardboard. He even rigged up miniature streetlights with small battery packs.
So calling it a hobby just completely misses the mark.
Completely. This was a full-time job for him, a vocation, driven by this need to construct a new reality where he wasn't alone anymore. Think about the hours, the sheer physical effort, the painstaking detail. Not just one little house, but an entire miniature environment, functional, complex.
An act of architectural devotion, as you said. And he had a specific reason, didn't he? He told people why he was doing it.
He did. When neighbors or later officials asked him what he was doing, Fred was apparently always very clear. He'd say he was making a neighborhood for when his friends came back.
For when his friends came back.
Yeah. And it wasn't like, I hope they come back. It was preparatory. He was certain. He was building the container, waiting for the community he was sure would return.
But of course, the people.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, others perhaps,
mm-hmm.
they weren't coming back. So the devotion, it must have shifted.
Exactly. That's a crucial point. The focus moves away from the memory of the lost companionship, and it lands squarely on protecting the fragile world he built in anticipation of it.
The creation itself becomes the new focus. The loyalty transfers to the cardboard.
The grief gets channeled entirely into preserving and expanding this artifact he's made. And that brings us to our first structural parallel from the index. It helps us understand this relationship, this dynamic between the maker and the object they create.
Okay, where does the index take us first?
We look at the entry for Buzz Lightyear, Russell Kearney. Now, Russell Kearney, for listeners who might not know this one, he was this eccentric engineer, built a highly customized hyperflight launch mechanism out in the desert.
Right, the giant failed machine.
Exactly. And what's key about Kearney is the intensity of his devotion, not to flight itself necessarily, but to the launch. The machine, it was huge, detailed, and ultimately, yeah, it failed. But the index callback is, echoing Buzz Lightyear, artifacts outlive their makers. Kearney might have been forgotten, maybe ridiculed, but the physical remains of his launch site, they became a fixture, documented, analyzed long after he was gone.
So applying the template to Fred, the cardboard neighborhood is his artifact. It's the physical proof of his ambition to beat isolation. He poured everything into making something that would last, even if he couldn't maintain it forever.
And the very fragility of it, the cardboard, the temporary nature, it ironically gives it more weight, doesn't it? These weren't just structures. They were monuments to a devotion so intense it had to become physical.
So we have to see that neighborhood, the little streets,
yeah,
the houses, not as junk or models.
But as sacred architecture, yeah. They're the tangible leftovers of his desperate search for meaning after loss.
Okay, so that sets the stage for Fred's internal world. But then things start to shift externally, don't they? Part two. Silhouettes and whispers. When the neighborhood grew strange.
Exactly. We pivot here. The story moves from this profound, maybe eccentric tragedy of isolation towards something genuinely uncanny. As the neighborhood got bigger, more complex, how people saw it started to change.
Curiosity turns into unease.
Unease is a good word. It wasn't sudden. It was this creeping realization, especially among passersby. Apparently, children noticed at first, maybe they're more open to the unusual, the cardboard neighborhood started projecting this feeling of internal life, even though it was obviously just cardboard.
And the key observation, the specific thing people mentioned was the silhouettes, right?
That's it. People reported seeing figures moving inside the little cutout windows, especially at dusk or at night when Fred's little battery-powered streetlights were on.
What do they look like?
Indistinct. Dark shapes, just silhouettes against the faint light inside.
Now, the sources are clear on this point, right? The ambiguity.
They insist on it. These figures were described as distinct from Fred himself. And crucially, no one, not officials, not neighbors, not kids playing nearby, ever saw a person go into or come out of that cardboard neighborhood. It was like this sealed system.
Okay, but let me push back a bit here.
Mm-hmm.
The rational explanation, wouldn't it be Fred himself?
Yeah.
Moving around inside, maybe shifting the large cardboard pieces, or even just, yeah, you know, playing with shadows out of loneliness.
Yeah.
Why are the sources so sure these figures were separate from him?
That's the vital point and why it gets unsettling. The descriptions suggest movement happening in multiple houses simultaneously. Impossible for one person. And furthermore, witnesses reported seeing Fred just sitting outside the neighborhood sometimes, watching the houses himself while this internal movement was still happening.
So he was observing it too.
Apparently. The ambiguity holds because the witnesses were credible. They knew Fred was alone, grieving, maybe losing touch, but they couldn't rationally explain the activity inside his creation.
So the space itself, because of his intense focus, started to behave as if it were inhabited, whether that's collective projection from the mystery or something else drawn to Fred's intense devotion. The neighborhood gave off this constant vibe of internal life.
And this is where a second structural analogy comes in. It's about how absolute focus can actually transform your perceived reality. This links to the index entry for real-life Mario, Marco Bellini.
Marco Bellini.
Right.
Right? The guy who thought the Rome sewer system was the final level of a video game. Intense delusion.
Absolutely. Bellini spent years down there in the dark, complex tunnels. The index callback says, like Mario, chasing the castle changes the player first.
Okay. Explain that connection.
Bellini's intense focus on the game literally changed his perception of reality. The sewer wasn't a sewer anymore. It was a game map. The real danger, darkness, collapse, rats became enemies. His goal became existential. He was Mario.
So applying that to Fred, his singular overwhelming focus wasn't just on building the neighborhood. It was on maintaining its reality as a living community.
Precisely. By dedicating himself completely to this structure, he fundamentally altered his perception of who or what lived there. the rules of his internal reality started to override the physical reality of cardboard and glue.
So the strange figures, the silhouettes, they stopped being just shadows or tricks of the light for him.
They became residents, requiring care, attention. Fred's mind, maybe fractured by grief, supplied the inhabitants needed to justify the existence of his demanding cardboard world. The space was transformed by the sheer force of his belief. It stopped being just a comfort, and it started being this demanding system he had to serve.
A system with its own rules, which inevitably leads to conflict, doesn't it? Part three, the external intrusion and the plea.
Yes. This intense, self-contained world Fred built was, well, it was always going to collide with the outside world. Bureaucracy. Reality.
The neighborhood just got too big. It sprawled out of his yard into the public park. Complaints started, and eventually the city had to step in.
It's that classic collision of systems, isn't it? The city wasn't necessarily targeting Fred personally, at first anyway. They were targeting a code violation.
What specifically?
Fire risk, mainly.
Right.
All that cardboard, the glue, it's incredibly flammable. And also, encroachment on public land. You can't just build structures in a park.
And this wasn't like one warning and then eviction.
No, the sources suggest it was a process. Multiple warning notices over weeks, citing specific municipal codes. There were probably attempts at mediation, maybe low-level parks department people trying to reason with him. They might have been sympathetic initially, but they were bound by the rules.
Deadlines, penalties, the usual bureaucratic process.
Mm-hmm.
But for Fred, those deadlines must have felt existential.
Exactly. The bureaucracy was trying to dismantle his entire perceived reality. They were trying to tear down his grief structure.
So his reaction when they finally came with a formal eviction order, it wasn't just anger or disappointment.
No, it was described as intensely emotional, a desperate, almost primal plea. He begged them, wept apparently, begged them not to tear down the neighborhood.
This is where it shifts, isn't it? From just eccentricity to something much deeper. A sense of responsibility.
That's the turning point, narratively. He's not just protecting his project anymore. He's protecting his dependents. The silent, smiling figures he made.
And the specific reason he gave. It's just devastating. He didn't plead for himself, for his time, his effort. He said, and this is a direct quote from the notes, he said his friends didn't like being left alone.
That line, it transforms everything. The cardboard figures aren't objects anymore. They're dependents. They have feelings. They fear abandonment. Fred wasn't just guarding cardboard. He was shielding his friends from distress. This is that moment where, as the source puts it, innocence curdled into devotion. His grief demanded he protect the paper and glue from being abandoned.
So you have this clash, the city's rules, visible, written down, fire hazard, public property, versus Fred's rules. Invisible, self-imposed. These people cannot be abandoned.
And this structural conflict, this clash of systems, is really well illustrated by our third index entry. It concerns the Disney World controlled zone.
Okay, Disney World. How does that connect?
Well, Disney World looks open, free, magical, right. But underneath, it operates under an incredibly rigid set of internal rules. Hidden protocols.
Character timings, parade routes, crowd control, even surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
All designed to maintain this perfect illusion of happiness and order.
Precisely. And the index callback is, as in Disney World, control hides best in plain sight. Fred's neighborhood, even though it was small, fragile, made of cardboard, it operated under similar, though deeply personal, hidden protocols.
And the primary rule, the unwritten law of his world,
was non-abandonment, continuous care. His entire existence became dedicated to upholding this internal controlling protocol.
So the eviction notice wasn't just a legal threat. It was a direct violation of his neighborhood's supreme law.
Mm-hmm.
The city was forcing him to break his own code, to abandon the friends who, in his reality, relied on him.
Yes. Because Fred's entire system, his reality, rested on that single pillar. You don't leave him alone. The city's ultimatum forced an existential collapse. Based on his own rules, he could not comply. When the two systems collided, his private world demanded a final, absolute loyalty.
Which leads us, tragically, to part four. The fire and the final recording.
Yeah.
Weeks after that final notice.
Weeks later, yeah. The inevitable happened. The cardboard neighborhood, all that highly combustible material, it caught fire.
How did it start? Do we know?
The sources don't specify the ignition. It could have been accidental, given the materials and maybe the jury-rigged lighting. Or it could have been intentional. The aftermath suggests intention.
Because the fire was fast consuming. Fire crews arrived. The structures were already collapsing.
Yeah.
But when they put it out, the scene wasn't random, was it?
Not at all. There was a profound intentionality revealed in the ashes. They found dozens of the cardboard figures the friends Fred had made and painted.
Arranged how?
In a perfect, precise circle. The precision points to a ritual, a final, planned gathering.
And the figures themselves. Were they just charred remains?
Damaged, yes, but identifiable. Fred had painted each one with a distinct, seemingly indelible smiling face. So even in that final circle, surrounded by destruction, they projected this image of absolute companionship, perfect happiness, a final ceremony dictated by their creator.
It sounds like Fred wasn't trying to save his world then, but maybe? Facilitate its ending? A shared ending?
That's how the scene reads. And his body was found in the exact center of that circle. The structures had burned down around him.
Facing something specific.
Yes. Facing one single object that stood out from the charred paper and glue. It was a hard plastic doghouse. Bright red. Somehow it had survived the flames, at least partially. It acted as this focal point, a kind of shrine in the middle of the ceremony.
And inside that plastic doghouse, that's where they found it.
That's where they found the final, devastating piece of evidence, a small, battery-powered tape recorder. Slightly singed, but it was intact.
The fact that he recorded it, it just confirms the intentionality of the whole horrible event.
Yeah.
He wanted this moment documented.
Can you imagine being one of those firefighters? You've just dealt with this deeply sad, strange scene, born of isolation, and then you find this. A message from the center of the tragedy. They pressed play.
And they heard Fred's voice. Soft. Resigned.
Soft, maybe resigned, yes, but absolutely clear in what he was saying. It was a final, almost tender farewell to the world he'd made. He just said, "Good night, neighbors."
Pause. And then silence on the tape.
A silence. The sources note about 8 seconds of just quiet. The sound of the recorder running, maybe the distant crackle of embers. You feel the full weight of his final solitude in that gap.
Pause. But then, after that silence.
After the silence when you think it's over, a reply. Faint, but distinct, captured clearly on the tape. A whisper.
Saying what?
Good night, Fred.
Wow. Okay, part five, interpretations. Loneliness versus the echo, that final exchange. It changes everything, doesn't it?
It forces a complete reevaluation. The entire story pivots on that faint whisper. Is it confirmation? Proof of some genuine non-physical companionship? Right. An unseen entity acknowledging its creator?
Or the alternative.
Or is it the ultimate auditory echo of profound terminal isolation? Fred's mind needing that reply so desperately that it manifested it. So powerful it was actually recorded.
The narrative just splits right there. Without the whisper, it's clear. Heartbreaking, but clear. A man consumed by grief, leading to self-destruction.
But add that whisper, documented by a machine, an objective device. It introduces something that goes beyond psychology. It makes the story permanently unnerving. You can't easily dismiss it.
So if we take the psychological path, Fred's mind was so totally immersed in the reality of his neighborhood that in his final moments, the desperate need for a response for farewell back was externalized, like an auditory hallucination so strong it imprinted on the tape.
Which in a way proves how real it was for him. The neighborhood wasn't just cardboard, it was truly inhabited in his mind.
But whichever way you lean, psychological or something else, the story becomes defined by these themes, right? Objects standing in for people, and also critically erasure. Fred himself was physically erased by the fire.
Consumed. But his story, ironically preserved by that tape, became almost legendary in that area. His destruction achieved something his life couldn't. Validation.
I mean.
Think about it. If the city had just come with bulldozers and cleared the lot, Fred would just be another sad, forgotten eccentric. But because he chose fire, and because he chose to record that final farewell, the act of destruction itself became the evidence. Proof of the neighborhood's existence in his world. Proof of the depth of his connection to it.
Right. The tragedy exists because it was documented in its final moments. And this idea, documentation emerging from deletion, connects to our final index analogy.
It does, perfectly. We look at the index entry for Klaus Richter, der Schatten. This deals with the historical deletion of a soldier's existence.
Klaus Richter, the soldier whose records were all systematically erased, wiped from history.
Exactly. His files, his mentions, his physical presence and records all removed. The only lasting evidence that Richter ever existed was the gap itself. The missing file number, the empty space in the ledger, the index callback is stark. Like Klaus Richter, erasure becomes the evidence.
And Fred's final act mirrors that. His self-erasure through fire created the undeniable proof. The fire didn't just destroy the cardboard. It authenticated the internal reality of the man who built it. His physical disappearance, the erasure, is the reason we're even talking about this. The tragedy persists because the record survived the destruction.
Which brings us to the critical thought for you, the listener. Fred Foster built this complex, detailed, fragile world specifically to keep loneliness at bay. He made himself its sole guardian, its resident expert, its only confirmed human inhabitant.
His story forces us to think about what we build, doesn't it? Physically, maybe emotionally, digitally. The structures we create to fend off that darkness, that isolation.
And we have to ask, what happens when the external world bureaucracy, social pressures, just plain reality threatens those careful, necessary constructions we rely on? Fred chose his constructed reality. He chose it over the messy and different external world that, in its own way, was trying to intervene, maybe even save him.
Couldn't reconcile the two.
He couldn't. The cardboard neighborhood and the enduring mystery of that final recorded whisper. It stands as this haunting testament to the sheer intensity of the human need for connection. A need so powerful it can apparently conjure a silent, smiling community from nothing more than recycling, glue, and an absolutely unyielding devotion.
And that whisper. It ensures we can never definitively know, can we? Did Fred Foster truly die alone? Or was he, in the end, surrounded by the only company he believed he had left?
The ambiguity is what gives the story its lasting power.
When the fire died, all that was left was the sound of cardboard folding in on itself.